Let me start with this graph here, which Dave Charbonneau already showed and Josh Wynn as well. This is the mass versus the radius of transiting exoplanets. I will show a couple of versions of this during my talk. Before that, let me talk about a few details here. The colors here represent, they're a bit coarse, but they represent the equilibrium temperature of these planets. Blue meaning cold and red meaning very hot. The size of the dots represent the surface gravity of the planet, which, as Josh mentioned, is very precisely measured. This planet here has very high surface gravity, and some of them have, the inflated ones have very low surface gravity. This is an outline of what I will try to summarize in these 30 minutes. I will talk about the transiting exoplanet statistics. TEP stands for transiting exoplanet. I will talk about the role of ground-based projects, and I will overview all of these projects, at least the ones that produce discoveries. I will then talk about how a ground-based survey works from my own experience, but it can be generalized for other projects. I will briefly mention the false alarm statistics, as much as we know it from our own follow-up. Then limitations of ground-based observations. And then I will try to go through a few of the 68-13, that's the space-based, transiting exoplanets. This is perhaps your last chance to see a few of these if you lost track of this flood of TEPs. And probably that's where I will stop. The other ones are less interesting. And this is actually, there is some healthy redundancy between our talks, as you will notice. Josh just summarized way more interesting applications that are based on transiting exoplanets. The ground-based ones so far presented us with, of course, true mass and radius of planets around bright stars. And Rossiter effect was measured for a number of them. These were ideal targets for Spitzer measurements because the host star is bright. And I think these are the prime points out of the huge number of interesting science projects. Further, I think it was not highlighted yet that the planet, through its transit itself, does constrain the stellar parameters through the density of the star. So actually, such a system, a transiting exoplanetary system, is ideal for determining both the parameters of the star and the planet together. Finally, ground-based observations and these transit projects are very useful for confirming and characterizing the future space-based observations. Sometimes you need better spatial resolution than you got from the space, and then the existing ground-based tools and experience can be used to follow up a transit. Or one can use different band passes to nail down various parameters, such as limb darkening. And these are some near future applications, transit timing variations, perturber bodies, and exomoons. So all these can be done based on ground-based discoveries, and of course, space-based discoveries, as long as they're bright enough. As regards to the statistics, just a few days ago I checked, and there are 68 confirmed announced transiting exoplanets. By announcement, I mean the coordinates have been published and the planet has been identified. And radio velocity searches discovered 6 of these that later on were confirmed to transit. So these are the 6 here. They're all very famous. They're usually around bright stars. There was one, notably, that I remember being very interesting, HD189733b, where even the transit was discovered through spectroscopy. Because it's a short period planet, and François Bouchy, observing this from Haute-Provence, realized there is a planet there, and he observed it during the expected transit, and he saw the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect. And then later on, it was confirmed to photometrically transit. And the other one, which is playing with the devil, is a Spitzer observation based HD80606b, which the first sign that this system is aligned along the line of sight was based on Spitzer observations. And then the transit was found later on. So we have 62 transiting exoplanets that were discovered by surveys, and 6 of them that were discovered by radio velocities, 55 from the ground and 13 from the space. These are the Corot and Kepler results. And just for nostalgic reasons, I pulled up this table from Keith from 2001, which lists transit search projects 1 to 24. And all kinds of parameters. And this is the expected planets per month found by this project. And out of these projects, 5 of them found planets. Let's see, TRACE, EXO, HETNET, SuperWASP, and OGLE. And MIRTH is not listed here because it was not non-existent at the time. I think that's sort of the list. It is a natural question what happened to many of these and what are the reasons behind not finding planets. So I will talk about that during this talk. And here is the field of view of these ground-based surveys projected on the half the hemisphere. You see actually KELT and in BOTUS, and you see Hercules here and SuperWASP field of view, and you see Cygnus here and EXO-STRIP, HETNET's field of view. So this is just showing how some of them are very wide field and some of them are very narrow field projects. It's sort of a there's a distinction between those pencil beam surveys and like OGLE and the wide field searches like SuperWASP. And so now I will show a few slides on the projects that presented planets, right? Here is OGLE in Chile and Las Campanas. And here is STARE. I copied this from the net. And there is PSST and SLUTH, and they together comprise the TRACE project. And there is EXO with these two wide-angle telephoto lenses at Maui, Haleakala. And this lies very close to my heart because I built it. This is the HET, little horseshoe mount. And that's a big lens hood, which we naturally take off and we observe for obvious reasons. There is the WISE HET telescope, which is in the Negev Desert in Israel. Here is SuperWASP with 8 lenses in a 2x4 arrangement. That's why it has a large field of view. And there are 2 of these, one in the north at La Palma, Canary Islands, and one in South Africa. And here's MIRTH. As far as I know, these are the ground-based projects that produced transiting exoplanets so far. And in addition to these, there is a big community effort that I really enjoy keeping track of every day. One is transitsearch.org. It's already on Twitter. So if you have free energies and know enough emails, you can spend all your time on Twitter. And then there is the amateur Exoplanets Archive, where amateur astronomers can upload their observations and they can keep track of transiting planets. And these have been extremely useful. I will show at least one planet that was discovered thanks to this. And finally, the third one I would show is the TRESCA, which is the Czech Variable Star Observers Association. They have their interface called TRESCA, which is purely for transiting exoplanet follow-up, and it's like a forum. And it's full of news and data and uploads and predictions. It's extremely interesting. And I think some of the planet discoveries can be due to such efforts. So how does a ground-based survey work? Well, conceptually, it is very simple. And I can break it down to these points. So first, you build something, you operate it, you acquire data, you transfer it back to your host institution. Then you reduce it, calibrate it, do photometry, and generate light curves. After the light curves are generated, you realize that they are not very good in quality, and you apply all kinds of massaging to the data. One is called the trend filtering algorithm, and the other one is called SISRAM. These make nice light curves from ugly light curves. Then you apply a transit search method to find periodic box-shaped transits. This is the BLS algorithm, which is very popular. There are some other tools. Then after this, you probably find hundreds of candidates in just one field of view. And then the question is how to evaluate these. And there are many tools, and this is usually a long manual work evaluating candidates and ranking them. Then, after we come up with a list, and this is true for all the projects I know of, there is a reconnaissance follow-up phase. When these candidates are checked with low resolution or low signal to noise spectroscopy and photometry, and if they are actually compatible with the transiting planet, then they enter confirmation mode follow-up. For SuperVOS, these two are basically done in one step. Finally, if a planet survives all these attempts of killing it, then the results are analyzed and we try to derive physical parameters. So here's the same thing in a little chart. We start with a ground-based survey, a telescope, we generate light curves, we search for the transits with BLS and the trend filtering algorithm, we do perhaps a little follow-up, then we check all the light curves and we classify them and analyze them, and then a few of them survive here, like a flat bottom transit, which are subject to rejection mode spectroscopy, checking for eclipsing binaries, crazing eclipsing binaries, or triples, or FM binaries. And if the candidate survives, then it's subject to photometry follow-up, sometimes the other way around. And if the candidate survives this step, then it goes on to high precision radio velocity follow-up. And so now I will show a few images just how a ground-based survey works from my own experience, but this is true for most of them. There's a lot of tinkering with, a lot of homemade parts, a lot of ever-temporary designs. Here is the HETNET telescopes, and this is a electronics that we built, as you can see it from it. It's clearly not some state-of-the-art thing. Here are the telescopes at Whipple Observatory, which is has a very good astroclimate and very good sky. And here are two other head telescopes on Mauna Kea. And here we are for scale. So these are really tiny instruments. And that's how a field of view looks like of a wide field instrument. I took one example of the Head South project. But typically, they generate 8 by 8 degree images on the sky, which are very pretty. And there's also a huge effort of coping with the data flow of the tens of terabytes of data coming in and trying to store them and archive them and manage them, which you can see here behind the scenes. And that's an important diagram, the magnitude of the star versus the RMS of the light curve, and three different methods. The raw light curves are the red, the green light curves where we do some decorrelation with parameters that we call external parameters like temperature and air mass, and the blue dots here show the trend filtered light curves, where each light curve is checked or compared to thousands of other stars and systematics in the field of view. And so as you can see, at I magnitude of 8, we can reach a precision of about 3 millimeg RMS at 5-minute cadence. And again, this is HETNET, but it's typical of most transit projects I know of. And here is a light curve. This is the raw light curve. You don't see any transit. This is the trend filtered light curve. You see a nice transit. That's the difference. And this is HETP1, by the way. And the reason behind the light curve being such noisy is this is a 10 arc second binary star, which is elongated on our frames. And so the aperture photometry was very poor in performance. And here's a little demonstration of the BLS algorithm I showed. This is time versus magnitude. This is about 2 months here. This is a light curve. Obviously, you don't see any transit unless you have very special eyes. And this is the BLS spectrum, frequency versus the power. You see this peak here showing that there's a very significant signal and all kinds of aliases. And then I just overplotted all the transits on this light curve again. You don't see them individually. But if you fold the same light curve, this is what you get. It's striking. It's there. This is a very high signal-to-noise detection of over like 15. Which is an unconfirmed planet. So this is a statistic. So I mentioned I will tell a few numbers on how many false alarms we have. And we so far have found over 1,000 transiting exoplanet candidates since 2003. And then these are important percentages. the FM binaries, grazing, eclipsing binaries, and triples all together are about half of this sample. Giant stars are about 18%, and resolved blends, where we actually with high resolution photometry we see the neighbor, are 11%, and we have a 10% false photometry rate. Oh, and finally, rapid rotators are another 15%. They may have a planet, but it was not easy to follow them up with spectroscopy. So these are roughly the statistics we have in HetNet, and it's an evolving statistics. For example, recently, in the last few years, we have been much better in excluding giants right away. And these are other steps we perform, just to highlight the digital speedometer or the trace spectrograph at Whipple Observatory. A huge amount of time have been spent on following up candidates under the leadership of David Latham, and additional low signal to noise spectroscopy with ANU 2.3 meter and other instruments all around. And our workhorse for confirming planets is Keck. For the WASP survey, it's Coralie, HARPS, or in the northern hemisphere, it's the 1.9 meter at Haute-Provence. And an important point is that for a transiting exoplanet, the radio velocity follow-up is somewhat simpler than for a radio velocity detection because you know the phase in advance. So you can target your this is time versus the expected radio velocity of the planet, and you can time your observations at the ideal quadratures in planning the observations. So one can be very efficient. And some targets can be false alarms even after getting a radio velocity curve. Here's an example of a 1 km/s amplitude RV curve, implying a few Jupiter mass companion to this star. Here's a nice transit here. And here are the bisector variations, which measure how much the spectral lines are distorted. And one can see a huge correlation with phase. This is a triple system, which mimics a planetary transit. These are very expensive to follow up because it requires even Keck time. And here's an example of a survivor, HET P2, which has a nice light curve there and has a radio velocity curve with a 1 km/s amplitude. And so here are the limitations of ground-based surveys. Of course, duty cycle, either due to weather or just because of the sun rises, you cannot observe if you have a single station. That's one of the main limitations. The other one is long-term stability. From space, you can get spectacular long-term stability. And the third one is our atmosphere, having mostly extinction and scintillation. So here are some numbers with a 10-centimeter telescope at sea level, which you don't want to do. But if it's at sea level, then at a 200-second integration, you get about a 1 millimag scintillation noise. So that limits how small a planet you can actually detect. And for a 1-meter telescope, with a 20-second integration, you get about 0.6 millimag at high air mass. There are other limitations in general in confirming a transiting exoplanet, which holds for both ground-based and space-based surveys. That's the RV precision, the stellar jitter, the precision of the stellar isochrones or systematics, and parallaxis, and the blend analysis. These are problems that are present for any survey trying to find transiting exoplanets. And here is something related to the recovery. This is the transiting planet's period as a function of the recovery rate of a transiting exoplanet as a function of its period, assuming realistic weather and a number of configurations. One site observes the field. Two sites observe the field that are longitudinally separated, and three sites observe the field. And so you see, if you have a network on Earth, then you can detect planets at 15-day periods from a transit survey with 20% chance in about a two-month observing with realistic weather conditions. And this is this graph that I just showed is was created for a project on the southern hemisphere called Head South, which is shown here. It's a collaboration between CFA, PUC, Australian National University, and the Max Planck Institute. And that has three stations on the southern hemisphere. Here is one in Chile on the ridge close to the Ogle telescope. So we are trying to beat this. Okay. this transient recovery function. So now I will enter the last 10 minutes of my talk. That's perfect. I will briefly, I spent the weekend with a little cinematography. I tried to make a movie of all known transiting exoplanets in various space, various dimensions, and I realized I will show snapshots of that movie, and during the questions I can show the movie as well. I try to highlight the most important ones and then tell a few sentences on each of them. So here is HG209458b. This is mass versus radius, log scale. This is linear scale. Here are the known ice giants or gas giants of our solar system. So this was clearly inflated, and it was discovered in 99. The second one came 4 years after that, and it was thanks to Ogle. This is Ogle TR56. It has a 1 Jupiter mass, and it has a 1.2 day period. As you see, it's very hot compared to this one. This is not the error bar. This is just a crosshair showing the new information on the screen. And then a few other Ogles come, Ogle TR136. And there are a number of other Ogles that appear that shows Ogle was the most successful transit search back in 2003 and 4. These planets, by the way, are very faint, and the host stars are 15th magnitude, and confirmation was a big challenge. It used the largest telescopes. And the first one that was discovered by a wide field survey was TRACE 1. Here we go. It's around an 11th magnitude K dwarf. And then a very interesting one showed up in 2005, thanks to the N2K survey, Deborah Fisher, Bunei Sato, and collaborators, HD149026b. This was close to Saturn mass and was very compact. And so people thought, well, this may have a huge 60 Earth mass core, and there was a huge amount of follow-up effort going into this target because it's bright. Here's HD189733b, which is famous because it, again, it's one of the brightest systems on the sky. It's around a K dwarf, and this is the one Joshwin just showed, has no Rossiter anomaly. And in fact, this star has an M dwarf, the host star has an M dwarf neighbor, which is associated with it. So this is one system in a binary. And then the EXO survey succeeded in 2006. Presenting XO1b, and then the HETNET survey presented HETB1b, which was virtually the, or basically the second inflated hot Jupiter, other than Ogle TR56, which was relatively faint and not well characterized at that time. And then the WASP survey in 2006 also announced two planets, WASP 1 and 2. And then I think a breakthrough happened in 2007 when a companion to Gliese 436, an M dwarf, was found. This was discovered by radio velocity searches, and you see it's very, here is the planet. It's relatively cold compared to this population, and it's very low mass. It's a hot Neptune. By the way, here is the period versus surface gravity plot. So far, it's very nice. You see this linear relation. This was the last time in 2007 May, and this still looked OK. Because then came HETP2 here, which was 10 Jupiter mass and 1 Jupiter radius. And on the same diagram, it was a total outlier. Of course, the relation still holds. You have to just reject it. And and a few heavy mass planets showed up around this time in 2007, October. I remember HD17156. This was discovered, the transit was discovered by two amateur astronomers from Italy and someone from La Palma. It was known from radio velocity searches that it is a 21-day period eccentric planet. But this is thanks to transitsearch.org and Barbieri. And I'm showing Ogle TR182 because Ogle survey strikes back in 2007 after 4 years presenting a new planet. And then Lupus TR3, I'm showing this because this is the faintest one so far. It's a 17th magnitude host star from the southern hemisphere. And the planet confirmation is at 90-something percent level. It's not fully confirmed, but it's extremely hard to do at this magnitude. And then came XO3, which is at 13 Jupiter mass, and in the paper it was questioned whether this is already a planet or not. And then HETP7, which I just, Josh Wynn told about the Rossiter effect and 180 degree projected tilt. As you see from the color, it's red, it's very hot, it's very close in, it's in the Kepler field with 2.2 day period. And then Corot 2b here, another one at the high mass. BOSP10, another high mass one, 7.3 Jupiter masses, and tilted thanks to Rossiter measurements. And then came Corot 3b, which is 21 Jupiter masses. This was a sort of a disappointment for me, because up to this point, I thought I can model all of these planets just using a machine shop and aluminum and lead, and I can make models of them. But this has a mean density of 25 grams per cubic centimeter, so it's made it impossible to do it anymore. And then here is HETP8. This is interesting because of many reasons, but one is that if you see the paper, it presents 28 candidates in the paper and the statistics on why all of these failed. BOSP12 is a super hot one at 1.09 day period. HETP11 is the first transiting hot Neptune found by transit search. And here's what I mentioned earlier, HD 80606 and Greg Laughlin. And it's very cold from the color, as you see, and it's a very long period and very eccentric and fairly massive. HETP12 shows up at a very vacant place here, Saturn mass and Jupiter radius. HETP13, Corot 7, down there. At the discovery of Corot 7, we can say that this mass range is now three orders of magnitude. BOSP 17, and BOSP 18 is the 10 Jupiter mass, 1 day period, very hot planet. They're almost at the end, but GH1214AB is another breakthrough here. It's the first transiting super Earth found by from the ground, found by transit search. And then Kepler 7, HETP 14, and Corot 9 is the last one on my graph. And so here I finish, and I can show the same thing in the movie while you're asking questions. Thanks very much.
Okay, we have a lot of time for question and discussion. I can ask a really quick one, yeah, which is just for the HAT survey, how much do you move around the sky and sample different star fields versus linger a long time at each individual field? Are you covering many fields of view or staring just constantly in one direction?
So we usually spend about 2 or 3 months on a selected field on the sky, and that means one telescope in Arizona and one at Hawaii is observing that selected field. And that is done every clear night with 5-minute resolution. So far, we observed 10% of the northern sky with these observing tactics. And one field is observed as long as it's up. When it sets, we move on to the second one. So we don't move back and forth between any fields.
Okay, thanks. There were questions. Yes, Jack.
I have a few questions which I think are related, so I'll just throw them out at you.
Okay.
And you can decide what to find.
Okay, sorry, before you ask, this is just period versus surface gravity, the same movie in showing all the planets, so go ahead.
Okay. So the number of expected planets from transit surveys was pretty high. The number found is getting better, but it's nowhere near at the level one would have projected back in 2001 from that plot. And I'm wondering where the bottleneck is. Is it in confirmation? Is it in photometry? And then related question, you say you get 75% of the time devoted at Precision RV is for candidates which turn out to be good. But what percentage of candidates do you have to give to Precision RV, that you give to, for Precision RV, turn out to be bad? Mm-hmm. And what's going to be needed to convert, for being able to bind a planet as opposed to a planet candidate with transits without RV confirmation?
So to the first, to reply to the first question, what were the bottlenecks and why is this discrepancy between the expected numbers versus the reality? I don't think there is any single reason behind. There are many different smaller reasons that add up to this. One clearly was a gross underestimate of the difficulties of confirming planets. And the other one was probably an underestimate of the false alarm rate, I mean astrophysical false alarm rate. The third one was that wide field photometry is fairly difficult to do, and there was also a high percentage of false alarms just from the photometry itself. In the beginning, it was not 10%, it was more. At the time this project started, there was no, I can play them again, there was no much literature on red noise and trend filtering and SISRAM and all these. All these were developed because of the need to detect these 1% transits. And at the time of starting this, I never expected we would have 1,000 transit candidates that had been subjected to spectroscopy. I mean, so I think these are reasons behind. And from the statistical point of view, I know some authors try to address this. For example, Scott could comment on this, I bet, on whether, you know, what you would expect from the Ogle survey based on radio velocities. I think the prime observational reasons were these. As to your second question, so you said, you asked, what is the fraction of candidate that reaches high precision radio velocity observations and are duds? Because we really, I think the important number to keep in mind is the time. Time spent on planets and then time spent. But I understand this is from statistical point of view, it's interesting. So I think maybe then it's about half, 50-50. We spend obviously way more time on a planet that after three or four spectra seems to be to match the photometric ephemeris, and we see a radio velocity amplitude that's compatible with a planet. So then we can spend up to 30 observations on that, like with the example of HETB 13. It's only one planet, but it took 1.5 years of confirmation. So that's why this 75% is high, and then maybe the candidates, only about half of them are, or even less, maybe about 40%.
Okay. yeah. I had an answer also to Jack's question about the statistics. Just to say that we did the study in 2007 with François Fressin, and that first the what we're seeing with transits is consistent with what is being observed in radial velocity. Namely, that we were finding at the time, and now it's really clear that we were not seeing the tip of the iceberg, the planets that would be most bloated. We're really seeing the giant planets, and the two radio velocity and photometric surveys are consistent. When we looked at the coral sample, we found that. Everything is consistent for bright stars, I mean up to magnitude 14, so. But we had a problem that Corot hadn't detected as many giant planets as we would have thought, and it appears now that going back to the follow-up, it is a problem with the follow-up, where you have you rate your candidates also with Corot, and sometimes you have false negatives, so They are positives, but you rate them as negative. And I think this explains it. And now there are a few planets that have been found around the fainter stars with Koro. So the things are getting more and more consistent.
I just want to add one more thing to Gaspar's list of things that are different. And that's that most of the radio velocity surveys that people were using to base their statistics on the number of transiting planets they expect to find were magnitude limited surveys, which are also, as Fisher and Valenti showed, metallicity biased, and therefore have a higher incidence of hot Jupiters. And so, whereas transit surveys are not metallicity biased, and if you take that into account, you actually would expect to find fewer transiting planets in these signal-to-noise limited surveys. And that is a significant factor, actually, which partially explains this discrepancy.
This is Jeff Marcy. Gaspar, first let me just say congratulations. I'm not sure everybody here appreciates the extraordinarily heroic work you've done from designing and building the instruments all the way through the software and the analysis and organizing all the follow-up. I mean, to me, what you've done is just absolutely unbelievable. So congratulations again. My question goes back to something Dave Charbonneau brought up, which was that with spread out apertures, the optical photometric precision can be improved by averaging over the scintillation. And then he also mentioned that infrared photometric precision is increasing these days. Is there a way for you to do follow-up by using ground-based high-precision photometry on your candidates and then using a blender analysis to look for the F plus M or other eclipsing binaries? Is there a way for you to more cheaply do the follow-up with photometry?
Well, the problem with doing follow-up with photometry is timing or scheduling. So if there was a space-based observatory that could do photometry all time on any target you want, then it would be much simpler and way more expensive. But the problem is, you have a planet with, say, 4.4-day period, the first opportunity from a given observatory to observe a transit can be very far away. And even then, there is only a small chance, or some chance, that the weather is cooperating and you have telescope time and so on. So that's what we found to be a limitation in basing all our follow-up on photometry. Of course, I see some cases where extremely precise ground-based follow-up photometry can be done before spectroscopy. And in fact, on this little scheme I showed spectroscopy and then photometry. That was how we started, but by now these two things are mixed up. Sometimes we jump to photometry right away, and if we see a transit shape or a depth that's incompatible with a planet as we imagine a planet, then we don't do spectroscopy. I hope I answered your...
Bill Brookie. I'd like to ask about the ground-based surveys with respect to the space-based surveys. Space-based surveys are now well underway and finding very large numbers of candidates. How is that going to affect the ground-based surveys, in that clearly we don't have the difficulty you face with the daytime not allowing you to go follow up on your transit? So we would certainly expect to do a lot of the long period stuff that would be difficult for you. M-Earth seems to me an example of some ground-based system that's picked an area that the space-based systems don't do very well at. Mm-hmm. So how do you expect the ground-based systems to respond to the space-based systems?
Well, I think one natural response is to keep the targets bright, meaning brighter than 12 and a half. And that means enabling follow-up with current tools. This won't be true for the next decade, I think, when GMT is online. But right now, enabling follow-up of like transmission spectroscopy or occultation spectroscopy. So that will still mean 12th magnitude or brighter targets are valuable and are needed. Of course, I think the space-based surveys will find a huge number of very interesting things. Some of them you could have done from the ground, but much slower, or some of them you could not do from the ground at all. And we will see how these two collaborate. But I like the fact that a large set of the problems are common between these projects. For example, land analysis. Even though the photometry is exquisite and you can check astrometric misalignment of the target during transit, off and on transit, and things like that, there is a need to do ground-based follow-up, like adaptive optics, or check different bandpasses. And these are common for any target, wherever they came from. Another thing is radial velocity. If the blend analysis is based on bisector variations, then sort of the same signal-to-noise ratio spectra are required. So anyways, I see a lot of common grounds in the follow-up and confirmation of these two.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Dave?
Maybe two.
So there was that curious thing you mentioned about a planet with a density of 25. What was that?
Mean density, yeah.
What's that?
It's Coro Exo 3b. If you're asking about its nature, I don't know too much. No. It's, of course, yeah. Yeah, it's Coro Exo 3b. It's a 21, it's a three-day period, 21 Jupiter mass planet.
Hydrogen's a very compressible material.
Yeah. This is the, where's the pointer? So, no, it's not a joke at all. Yeah, Dave, I thought it was you had a question. No?
Last question.
No, maybe just I can comment on Coro 3b. I mean, this is completely predicted by models, because when you get to high masses, the hydrogen gets very degenerated. So it gets very compressible. And to come back on a comment that was made on the theorists this morning, this object was predicted 30 years ago. I mean, the fact that high-mass objects won't be with a less radius was predicted 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay, well, thank you again, Gaspar.
Thanks.
We now have coffee break until 4 o'clock. I want to remind you there are some posters out here that you should also be taking a look at. See you in 30 minutes.